Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Tuesday, March 18th. I'm Lauren Schmidt reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, changes to Humboldt's vacation rental ordinance become less permissive. Inmate apprehended after brief escape and swim across Humboldt Bay. And Eureka High School briefly placed under lockdown due to a security concern. Stay tuned, news on those stories and more coming right up. Earlier this Tuesday, a Humboldt County Correctional Facility inmate was apprehended after a brief escape from a work crew, which led to a dramatic pursuit that ended in the waters of Humboldt Bay. According to our news partner, Redheaded Black Belt, the incident occurred around 9:30 a.m. in Eureka, prompting dispatch to clear all communication channels as Eureka police personnel pursued the fleeing inmate. The suspect entered the water near the Sacco Amphitheater Park between L and K Streets in Old Town and began swimming towards Woodley Island. EPD officers requested backup from the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office and the Coast Guard in case a water rescue became necessary. However, the suspect appeared to be swimming competently and was not in distress. Upon reaching Woodley Island, the suspect raised his hands in surrender and was promptly taken into custody without further incident. The Humboldt County Sheriff's Office later identified the inmate as Christian Murphy, 28, of Eureka. In a press release, HCSO stated that Murphy had walked away from his inmate work crew while on a work detail in Eureka. Murphy was classified as a minimum security worker, serving a county sentence. He was transported back to the Humboldt County Correctional Facility, where he was rebooked and now faces charges for escaping a county jail. Eureka High School was placed under lockdown this afternoon, just after 2:30 p.m., due to what the school characterized as a safety concern. According to a post on the school's social media page, quote, EHS is currently in a lockdown due to a security concern. We are actively working with law enforcement to assess the situation and will provide updates as soon as possible. It is crucial that parents do not come onto campus or call the school at this time to allow authorities to manage this situation effectively, close quote. Approximately 30 minutes later, the school clarified that it had shifted into a soft lockdown and was waiting for further instruction from Eureka Police Department. But less than an hour after the incident began, the full lockdown was lifted and students were dismissed as usual. Eureka High School officials stated that they are continuing to collaborate with law enforcement and will defer to EPD for any further updates. KMA News reached out to the Eureka Police Department Public Information Officer for more information.
This is Laura Montagna from the Eureka Police Department. This afternoon, Eureka High went on a lockdown. There was a threat by phone, and we are investigating. We will have more information tomorrow. There will be a press release. And we thank all the parents and students for being patient. We'll make sure everyone is safe.
KMUD will continue to share updates as information is released. A majority of Humboldt County's Board of Supervisors voted to make changes to a vacation rental ordinance stricter. KMUD's Daniel Mintz reports.
After debating changes to Humboldt County's vacation rental rules, a majority of the Board of Supervisors voted to make them more stringent than recommended by staff and the Planning Commission. Amendments to the county's short-term rental, or STR, ordinance drew minimal public comment but lots of debate among supervisors at their March 11th meeting. The most debated change is for STRs on agricultural parcels. It loosens a requirement that SDRs on agricultural zone parcels be farm stays, vacation rentals that offer education on farm operations. At issue was a recommended to waive the farm stay requirement on agricultural parcels smaller than 5 acres. Supervisor Mike Wilson opposed the recommendation and highlighted the county's goals of preventing loss of long-term housing and preserving agricultural lands.
In some ways, what we're seeing here is a movement in the direction to make them even less viable for agriculture. But the thing is a lot of these smaller parcels are adjacent to other ag uses and other ag parcels. Mm-hmm. So actually the commercialization of those even smaller parcels are the further that you're allowing uses or without any kind of provision to look at them away from those things can impact neighboring parcels, because then there's now you start getting complaints and this, that, and the other, and they're not necessarily uses that are compatible.
The recommended change also allows non-farm stay STRs on ag-zoned parcels of 5 to 10 acres with a special permit, which involves noticing and public hearings if neighbors request them. Wilson supported reducing the lower end of the range from 5 acres to 2.5 acres. Board Chair Michelle Bushnell said areas in her Southern Humboldt district have 5-acre agricultural minimum parcel sizes, with surrounding parcels all being residential, and she noted the cost of the special permit process.
In certain areas, I'm going to reference to Carlotta, Hydesville area, and some subdivisions in the Southern Humboldt area where the zoning is still ag, but they are 5 acres, 5-acre minimums on those. Especially in Carlotta, Hydesville area, the surrounding area, while it is classified ag, is all residential, almost all residential. And I know specifically that this came from a couple applications out of the Carlotta, Hydesville area. And so the special permit is, what, $2,500?
Correct.
And for a process where there are many, many 5-acre parcels and they qualify, I don't know why those applicants would have to pay $2,500.
Bushnell also highlighted economic issues facing property owners, saying, quote, maybe they used cannabis in the past to be able to pay their bills. You could do that then, but you can't do that currently. And so this is a grasp for them to be able to make their mortgages. Supervisor Rex Bone also argued against making the rules tougher.
We do a pretty good job of shooting ourselves in the foot and over-regulating everything. These seem like minor. Would you consider these minor changes, John?
Yes.
But we'll spend a couple hours nitpicking the hell out of minor changes to provide income for people in a time where income's pretty stiff right now. I keep hearing, if we're having tough times, the people are having tough times. But we will overregulate this.
Supervisor Natalie Arroyo and Supervisor Steve Madrone supported Wilson's motion to make the minor changes less minor. They voted to reduce the lower end of the farm stay waiver and permit requirement thresholds from 5 acres to 2.5 acres. But for home share SDRs, where owners live in their rentals, the 5-acre threshold applies. Before the vote, Madrone said, quote, I'm concerned about our housing being converted because we have a serious housing crisis, and that's definitely raising rents and competition for houses for people that want to live in them long term. Bushnell and Bone dissented. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
The Mendocino County Department of Planning and Building Services will host 5 stakeholder meetings to discuss their short-term rental policies and their impact on local communities, real estate, and tourism. Each meeting will include a presentation on current STR policies, neighboring jurisdictions, approaches, and common concerns, followed by a roundtable discussion to gather input for a future ordinance. Those meetings will take place in Fort Bragg, April 9th, in Anderson Valley, April 14th, Willits, April 16th, Covelo, April 23rd, and Ukiah, April 30th, where there will be an in-person and virtual option. More details can be found at mendocinocounty.gov. CAL FIRE's Mendocino unit has rehired over 85 firefighters to respond to emergencies and focus on fire prevention, including broadcast burns and mechanical fuel management. Sarah Wraith with the Mendocino Fire Safe Council shares this interview with CAL FIRE Battalion Chief Shane Lampkin, discussing CAL FIRE's activities in Mendocino last year and the emphasis for 2025.
Today we'll hear from Shane Lampkin, who just joined CAL FIRE's Mendocino unit as the new battalion chief for the Public Information Officer and EMS Coordinator. He's in charge of CAL FIRE's local social media and email list, alerting the public to any incidents as well as vegetation management projects.
Tell me a little bit about your history with CAL FIRE and where you've been.
I've been in the fire service for over 20 years now. I've worked in four different administrative units. This is my fourth. Before this, I worked in the Shasta Trinity unit. I was a captain at a fire station. Also managed a hand crew and worked in the training bureau. I was also an engineer in the Shasta Trinity unit working at a station up in Burney. Before that, I worked a season or a year down in Riverside County as an engineer. I've also worked in the Tehama Glen unit as an engineer and a firefighter. I've also worked for other departments, the U.S. Forest Service. I've worked for a local department back at home, which is the Shasta Lake Fire Protection District. Got my feet into the program going through the Shasta College Fire Academy. I've been doing this ever since 2002, and I'm excited to keep doing this for the next 10 to 15 years.
How long have you been here?
I've been here since the week of Christmas.
Lampkin wasn't here for much of 2024, but he reported that last year CAL FIRE conducted 31 fuels reduction projects, completing over 5,000 acres. Almost half of that was accomplished through broadcast, or prescribed burns. The rest was done by crews using chainsaws and either chipping the brush or burning the piles of vegetation when conditions are conducive to controlled burns. A newly appointed prescribed fire battalion chief, Kevin Ryan, will coordinate the broadcast burns in the upcoming year. But Lampkin notes that these projects are complicated.
We have a lot of moving parts that are involved with this. We've got to meet with landowners and get approval to burn on their land. We have weather that gets involved. We have to make sure that the burning conditions are going to warrant a successful burn. We can't really get out there and burn while it's raining, while the humidities are high, because the fire just doesn't want to carry. We have to find that perfect window where we have dry fuels, but not so dry that it's going to cause a hazard. And then we also have to have perfect wind.
In addition to perfect weather, the burn has to coincide with a moment that is just right for the landowner and the availability of CAL FIRE resources.
We're trying to get these broadcast burns done at a time where it's right at the edge of a fire season. And sometimes fire season comes a little bit quicker than expected.
CAL FIRE aims to keep all wildfires under 10 acres, though some did exceed that acreage last year. In July, the Mina fire near Covelo grew to 98 acres and led to the year's first human fatality in a wildfire. Later that month, the Grange fire in Anderson Valley got up to 90 acres. No one died in that blaze, though one family did lose their home. But Lampkin said a lot of the fires were contained early.
Last year, the unit ran 127 fires. We had huge success last year of keeping our fires relatively small, squashing them as soon as we can, and the crew's doing great work out there.
So let's move into the upcoming year. I know that last year Chief Gunn was really enthusiastic about doing a lot of prescribed burns, but what else is on the docket for CAL FIRE in Mendocino County this year?
We started off the year pretty strong. We've already hired back over 85 firefighters to staff 10 fire engines and two crews. These firefighters are going to be used to start the season early, and with starting the season early, we're going to have a lot more boots on the ground for our fuels reduction projects and our vegetation management projects, our broadcast burns. There's more people involved, and it'll help with the planning on getting these projects done in a timely manner, especially if we're trying to meet those deadlines in between weather windows. This is crucial to our efforts of getting these projects done. We have a desire to make this place better and to protect it with all that we can, with the fire prevention efforts of fuels reduction, of the broadcast burn. We're here to make sure that our communities are safe.
And you mentioned you were part of a strike team that went down to LA. Can you talk a little bit about the local presence in that historic fire?
I went down as a heavy equipment boss. My task down there was to guide private dozers into putting fire line around the fire. We did send multiple engines down, multiple crews. We sent our helicopter down. We sent over 50 personnel to help support either administratively or boots on the ground fighting fire. This county showed a great presence down in Southern California to help the people that were in need. And we expect that for the people of California. Like, if there's a significant fire in this area, we're going to do what we can to draw resources in to help this area out. We don't want to see a fire like that in this community, but if there's potential for it, we're going to make sure that we're ready.
Anyone interested in following CAL FIRE on social media or signing up for email alerts can type Linktree CAL FIRE MEU into their browser. Thanks for tuning in to the Mendocino County Fire Safe Council podcast. Reporting for KMUD News, I'm Sarah Reif.
In state news, California Attorney General sues Trump administration for the sixth time in 6 days. This time, over a $148 million cut to education grants. Kennedy Coelho shares this report.
State Attorney General Rob Bonta announced yet another lawsuit Thursday against the Trump administration. This lawsuit is in response to $148 million in education grants to the state being slashed. This is a joint effort between AG Bonta and seven other Democrat state attorney generals and marks the sixth lawsuit led by Bonta in 6 weeks. These grants that fund teacher preparation programs were put in place by Congress to address the national teacher shortage by providing them scholarships and paid opportunities to be student teachers. Bonta says the effects of these grant terminations will be felt by many throughout the state.
Terminating these grants hurts aspiring teachers and the K-12 schools that rely on this federal funding to bring teachers into their classrooms. These terminations also hurt the University of California and California State University systems, which were granted $56 million, some of which has already been spent.
AG Bonta laid out how the grants are used at different California state universities. The CSU system produces almost half of the K-12 teachers in the state and one out of every 20 teachers nationally. These grant programs primarily focus on solving shortages of teachers in rural communities and for students that need more support. Cutting these grants, Bonta says, ultimately hurts the students. He gives as an example a grant that helps teachers live near schools.
Another is a $2.2 million five-year grant for Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo. This program provides living wage stipends for participants that agree to teach for 3 years in one of 32 high-need schools in the area that serve nearly 40,000 pre-K to 12th grade students. Aspiring teachers who are focused on bilingual education and special education. Terminating these education grants will clog the pipeline of passionate, qualified, good teachers from entering our classrooms.
A student from Cal State Los Angeles, Jonathan Z, is part of the Los Angeles Urban Teacher Residency Program. This program was made possible through the Teacher Development Grants. Z says he isn't in it for the money. He's here because he cares for the students. He said that these grants are essential because teachers can't do this without support.
There's a saying I hear all the time, which is you get out what you put in. But I am not an endless well of resources. I need to have the support of Dr. Williams. I need to have the support of the grants that are allowing me to pursue what ends up being my profession and my passion. And I need the support of our government. I need the support of not just the American politicians. I need the support of the American people.
U.S. District Judge Julie Rubin has scheduled a hearing for March 13th to determine if she will issue an injunction to block the cuts. For KPFA News, I'm Kennedy Quayle.
In national news, Trump hosts White House summit on Bitcoin and vows to make USA the, quote, crypto capital of the world. Christopher Martinez shares this report.
The United States has a strategic petroleum reserve, the world's largest supply of emergency crude oil. Canada has the world's only strategic maple syrup reserve to help regulate the price and supply of maple syrup. On Thursday, President Donald Trump signed an executive order creating a strategic Bitcoin reserve, what Trump calls a virtual Fort Knox for digital gold. And on Friday, Trump, who once said that digital currency Bitcoin, in his words, seems like a scam, welcomed cryptocurrency industry leaders to a White House digital assets summit.
Last year, I promised to make America the Bitcoin superpower of the world and the crypto capital of the planet, and we're taking historic action to deliver on that promise.
The Bitcoin reserve, along with another reserve for other cryptocurrencies, will hold cryptocurrencies seized in criminal or civil proceedings. Former President Joe Biden had led a crackdown on crypto, citing concerns over fraud. But Trump courted the crypto community during his presidential campaign. And at the White House summit, Trump said his administration is working to end what he describes as the federal bureaucracy's war on crypto.
Under the Bitcoin administration, regulators strong-armed banks. I mean, they really did. They strong-armed banks into closing the accounts of crypto businesses and entrepreneurs, effectively blocking some money transfers to and from exchanges, and they weaponized government against the entire industry. But I know that feeling also. Maybe better than you do.
The administration officials at the summit voiced their excitement about Trump's action, but even more, their gratitude to Trump. David Sacks, a tech investor that Trump named his crypto czar, told Trump, "Your administration is moving at tech speed."
We're all here today because of your leadership, your vision, and your generosity, and I really want to thank you for that. We're also here because of your desire to make America great and to introduce a golden age in America, including for digital assets. And we're here because of your love of innovators, or as you might say, high IQ people. Yeah, we know you love high IQ people.
Former hedge fund manager and now Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said the Trump administration will keep the U.S. the dominant reserve currency in the world.
And we are going to establish this Bitcoin reserve. We will use this authority to augment the asset side of the United States balance sheet. As I've said many times, President Trump is creating assets for the American people while most past presidents have created debt.
Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick says technology is at the foundation of the Trump presidency, and he says Trump will use technology to drive America forward.
The blockchain and Bitcoin technology are a key part of that thinking, and embracing that and here today shows how much a leader the Trump administration and our president is. He understands it. He embraces it. As you said, you're a pioneer in this place, and this is where we're going. We're using the blockchain, we're using Bitcoin, we're going to use digital assets to pound forward, and Donald Trump is leading the way. Can't be more proud of you today.
Thank you very much.
Trump's crypto actions are not without critics. Charles Edwards of the Capriol Fund called Trump's move a pig in lipstick, saying the reserve is just a fancy title for Bitcoin holdings that already existed in the government. Others criticize a lack of transparency. In any event, it's not clear how the new Bitcoin reserve will benefit Americans. But crypto czar Sachs says it's not going to cost taxpayers a dime. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
Trump's pick to head Medicare and Medicaid, Dr. Oz, faces Democrats' questions at confirmation hearing. Lucina Noel reports.
Senate Finance Committee Democrats pressed Dr. Oz on his ability to run the nation's Medicare and Medicaid services, including on his support for the Trump administration's proposed budget cuts, privatized Medicare, and mandatory work requirements. Such reforms, they say, will drastically reduce the number of people who qualify for the health insurance benefit. Oregon's Democratic Senator Ron Wyden was skeptical of Dr. Oz's commitment to people and families in need of insurance.
Based on the evidence I've just laid out, the American people have a variety of reasons to believe Dr. Oz will be fully on board with the Trump and Republican effort to cut Medicaid and to coddle the for-profit insurance companies.
Dr. Oz has a track record of promoting unscientific medicine and was called, quote, visibly out of step with his profession by the American Medical Association. During the pandemic, he spread misinformation about COVID-19 vaccines and treatment, including promoting the malaria drug hydroxychloroquine as a treatment for COVID, even though the medication was proven ineffective against the virus and comes with significant risks. Many senators, including Oregon Senator Wyden, questioned Dr. Oz on his history of promoting non-scientific medical products on his TV show, as well as on his record of evading taxes.
Dr. Oz is the second Trump nominee to come before the committee this year with a record of dodging Medicare and Social Security taxes. This tax loophole hurts Medicare and has benefited Dr. Oz by $440,000 in the last 3 years. Now, the doctor will testify about his concern for Medicare's well-being, yet he is unwilling to pay the same taxes that millions of Americans pay out of every paycheck.
Committee Democrats also asked for clarification on Dr. Oz's support for a controversial blueprint passed by House Republicans to cut over $800 billion from Medicaid and Medicare. According to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, this ambitious reduction in costs is not possible without significantly slashing benefits to Medicaid, a program that provides insurance to 1 in 5 Americans. Nevada Democrat Senator Catherine Cortez Masto also questioned Dr. Oz on his misconceptions about Medicaid fraud as the source of inefficiency.
Do you know how many Medicaid fraud units actually exist in the states to go after Medicaid fraud and prosecute for abuse? You don't.
I don't.
So it's in, you should know, because there are 53. And in 2024, they recovered $1.4 billion in fraud. That fraud was provider fraud. That was provider fraud. So I am all about addressing waste, abuse, and fraud, but let's be real here in how we do it and make sure now we're not kicking this couple and their needs for their daughter off of Medicaid because we have some concept which is false about who it is actually benefiting.
The Nurses Union, National Nurses United, said in a statement on Friday that it is opposed to Dr. Oz's nomination. In their statement, Nurse Nancy Hagans, president of the union, said, quote, his ultimate goal in seeking this position is lining his own pockets at the expense of our patients' lives, end quote. The union statement also notes that Dr. Oz previously owned over $500,000 of stock in United Healthcare, one of the largest Medicare Advantage profiteers. Medicare Advantage is a Medicare plan run by private, for-profit insurance companies and has faced scrutiny for unfair care denials and billing practices. Washington Democrat Senator Maria Cantwell pressed Dr. Oz on his lack of support for state-mandated Affordable Care Act plans.
And you believe in the Medicaid expansion that was done under the Affordable Care Act?
For some states, it made sense. For some, it didn't. I think that's a good example of how states should pick a path to take care of their most vulnerable, but they have to have a plan.
Well, wait. But the states that didn't don't have a plan. What plan did they have?
As we discussed in your office, with the Affordable Care Act, they have an opportunity to expand Medicaid, or they could use other tactics. As you know, 10 states haven't expanded.
I know, but you're saying that's okay?
As long as they have a plan to address their challenges of dealing with the underserved populations.
What plan?
Following the hearing, the Senate Finance Committee will schedule a vote to determine whether or not to move Dr. Oz's nomination forward to the entire Senate, where approval is likely given the Senate's Republican majority. For KPFA, I'm Lucienne Noel reporting from Oakland.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Katie Phillips. And thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Sarah Reith, Kennedy Coelho, Christopher Martinez, and Lucina Noel. KMUD News is online. You can find us on KMUD.org, Instagram, and Facebook. That's where you can see stories, links, and videos. And we are now streaming on most podcast platforms. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send us an email to news@kmud.org. Reporting from the KMUD studio in Redway, I'm Lauren Schmidt.